We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, and happy autumn.
Yes.
Happy fall equinox, yes.
We're going to get a couple of days of clean air before the smoke comes back.
So get your walks in now.
A couple of days of normal Puget Sound weather with normal airflow.
I'm going to quietly whimper here.
Yeah, as opposed to the record-setting levels of smoke in the air, where I think at least two times during the last couple of weeks, maybe the last 3 weeks, Seattle rated as worst air quality on the planet.
So. Lovely.
Great.
Diving into local events from the past week, and Bruce Harrell has been busy doing public presentations.
Been up to as usual this week. So first off, he announced that his favorite candidate from the get-go, Adrian Diaz, is his pick for the new permanent chief of police.
Scrape me off the wall.
Keep in mind that the finalists were only announced a couple of weeks ago, and there has only been one very brief public quote-unquote forum where the candidates answered six pre-approved questions, which I'm pretty sure they were fed ahead of time.
I can explain that. The fix was in.
Yeah. Now, by making his decision so quickly and choosing the current interim police chief, Harrell is signaling that he's fine with the status quo at the Seattle Police Department, and that making a change to the culture of the SPD is really not on his radar. But, Mike, I think you've got a clip from his press conference.
Yes.
That you can play.
Yes, this is right at the beginning. It's just over 4 minutes of a 45-minute press conference. So.
Well, really excited about the news we're about to celebrate with. And I got to tell you, I have a few thanks to give to the wonderful communities that stepped up for our administration. I'm thrilled to announce that I am officially appointing Interim Chief Adrian Diaz to be our permanent Chief Adrian Diaz. And let's give that a hand right now. I had a great conversation with Kevin Hall from Tucson and Eric Greening from the department. And I will tell you that the search committee, who I'll acknowledge in a little better detail shortly, they did their job. They did their job very well. That they presented, in my estimation, three candidates who could lead a department. Made my job hard. The process was the right process, not just charter governed, but I think we went above and beyond what the charter requires. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then I'll talk about why I made the selection that I did over the weekend. As many of you know, because you are following this, this was clearly a robust and community-driven process. The 14 very engaged and involved community members and stakeholders that are with us now, they have different ideas on what a great police department should look like or what a leader should look like. Some may say, I want 7-minute response times. I want the level of investigations done thoroughly and quickly. Some may say that I want police accountability unlike it, I've never seen it. We want to make sure that a racialized approach, an unreasonable force, is a thing of the past. And we have to acknowledge that it occurs, and we do not want it here in Seattle or anywhere else in this country. There could be some that says that they want to emphasize culturally competent officers. They want the complete morale change. Or someone may say, I want all of that, all in one. But they have priorities. I am very proud to say that I heard that there were some robust discussions amongst this group looking at the candidates that they had. We talked to community members over and over, a few statistics. In addition to conversations with the youth and communities of color and the immigrant community, faith leaders, small business leaders, we offered a community survey in 7 languages that was filled out by more than 1,300 residents. It's important to know that we had 15 applications. That was actually more than we had in our 2018 search. That was before George Floyd, before the pandemic, at a time where perhaps the political atmosphere might have been more conducive toward what we saw in Seattle. The committee did what they were supposed to do. They interviewed several people. They advanced five to the public safety experts, where those assessors administered a charter required oral and written competitive examination, unanimously sending me three highly qualified applicants. That was their job, and they did it well. I can say to all of you listening to my words right now that not one of these members thwarted the process, circumvented the process, and said, I want this person. You got five, you got three, this is who I like. Not one of them gave me that information. Now, I don't know what they did with their friends or what they did on their blogs. I don't read that stuff. But I'll tell you, it never got to me. So when I interviewed the three, they were robust interviews. And like I said, all three extremely capable. When I talk about One Seattle, I talk about having this kind of conversation where you can agree, you can disagree, but you lead also with listening and understanding the other perspective. That's how we're going to build a great city. That's how this chief and I are going to build a great department together.
Okay.
Oh, I okay. think I just puked all over the desk.
Yeah.
That was bad. I mean, you know, he didn't mention, of course, that Diaz was his favorite from the beginning. And that he didn't mention whether he actually listened to any of the input he got from other people.
So yeah, he has to talk right out of the box about how the search committee, quote unquote, did their job and, about the right process, because, you know, he knows that there are open questions about the process, especially whether Harrell himself paid attention to it. And, you know, he talked,
which he did not address. Yeah.
Yeah. And he talked on and on about, how not one of the members of the search committee told him they wanted this one candidate. You'll notice he didn't include himself in that. He was talking strictly about the search committee not thwarting the process. They just sent him three great candidates and gave him no other information. Well, that doesn't tell you a whole lot about his, how he made his decision. Other things that I picked out of that I thought were interesting was he mentions a community survey, but doesn't mention what was in it or what the responses were. Mm-hmm. So again, that's the city going through the process, but is anybody at the top really listening? Right.
Yeah.
And then he mentions the 14 community members on the search committee. I noticed when I was looking at the 14 members of the search committee that they don't really include representatives of communities that have been targeted by the SPD. Now, you could argue that Reverend Harriet Walden, who co-chairs the Community Police Commission, and who founded Mothers Against Police Harassment, does, but she is definitely part of the police accountability infrastructure now. And, I have, heard some folks saying that they wish she was more active in her role.
Yeah.
Now,
very much lower income communities were not represented in that process.
Yeah. And Harrell also does mention that the search committee had robust discussions about the candidates, but he doesn't mention what any of those discussions were about. So again, you know, here he is trying to lay open the process and say, oh, it was all really transparent. And yet you can listen to that 4-minute speech and come away with a whole lot more questions about the process.
But it was robust. I heard him say so several times.
Right. Right. And when you look at the members themselves, I mean, when you see a lawyer from Microsoft on there, you have to ask, is this really representative of the community? Or when you see the CEO, president and CEO of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, it's like, okay, you know, here's the folks who are going to advocate for more and tougher policing downtown. But what about the folks who initiated the complaints that that have led to the Seattle Police Department being under monitoring by the Department of Justice. I'm just not seeing them.
And I would say, you know, he never mentioned reform once, not mm-hmm. once. It's simply not a priority. And so the SPD, which has been under, you know, federal court monitoring for a decade now because the reform process has been so torturously slow and because the city has not managed to negotiate a contract with police officers, the union that has managed to pass muster with the federal court, you know, it's going to be another decade. Certainly it's not going to be until at least the end of Bruce Harrell's mayorship, whenever that is, because it's simply not a priority for him. Not a priority at all.
So, this week, Harrell also, tried to take credit for the work that the Green New Deal Oversight Board and the Seattle City Council did. He made a big splashy show of signing a new bill to allocate about $6.5 million in funds from the Jumpstart payroll tax to environmental programs identified by the Green New Deal Oversight Board. He also tried to take credit for the board itself and for Seattle launching their Green New Deal policies. But I should point out that the council adopted a list that was drawn up specifically by the Green New Deal Oversight Board, which is overseen by Shama Sawant's Sustainability and Renters' Rights Committee. The list of projects was discussed and voted on by the city council. Bruce Harrell really didn't have much to do with it other than rubber stamping the board's recommendations and then affixing his signature after the council passed the bill. You know, as mayor of Seattle. So I find it kind of interesting. I mean, he's no different from the usual things that mayors do here in Seattle, taking credit for other people's work. But I found this to be pretty transparently awful. I do want to talk for a minute about just a few of the things that will be funded by this new bill. And I know I've talked in the past about what the Green New Deal Oversight Board has been doing and that a major piece of their recent work has been in identifying what things the city can fund in order to move us in a clean energy direction. This year, 2022, that $6.5 million will fund things like $2 million for a clean heat program to help low-income folks transition from oil heat. I noticed that Bruce Harrell again announced that was his program. It's going to be implemented when he's mayor, but it's actually a program that was recommended by the board, not something he came up with himself. Mm-hmm. That money will also fund $400,000 for indigenous-led sustainability projects like rooftop solar, water cisterns, and food sovereignty projects. Particularly for their community gathering spaces. $2 million will go for climate resilience hubs. That's places where people can go to get away from excessive heat, especially lower income folks who don't have access to air conditioned spaces. $550,000 will go for the Environmental Justice Fund. That's a city fund that funds urban farming, habitat restoration, and other environmental projects throughout the city. $250,000 will go into apprenticeship programs to help set those up for training people to do clean energy jobs. $70,000 will go to startup money for the Seattle Clean Buildings Accelerator to help building owners, particularly ones that don't have a lot of money for capital improvements, to convert their buildings to clean energy. And $1 million will go to convert the city of Seattle's vehicle fleet to electric vehicles. And that includes the vehicles that often get missed, the medium and heavy duty vehicles in the city's fleet. Now, the Green New Deal Oversight Board recommended a total of about $6.5 million in projects for 2022. But for 2020, they also made recommendations for 2023. And they're calling on Mayor Harrell and the City Council to add $22 million in spending on environmental projects in 2023. Harrell is going to be announcing his his budget next Tuesday, and we'll see then if he's still waving the environmentalist flag once he releases that, and if he's included all 22 million of the Green New Deal Oversight Board's recommendations in that.
He may be waving the environmentalist flag, but the details of the budget are more important.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he's saying and what he's doing are not usually the same
thing. Not always the same thing. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But he does have a very keen ability to take credit for a lot of things.
Other people's work, yeah.
Yes, once you decode what he's trying to say.
Yeah. And it's not like he's like saying his administration is doing it. He literally says on these occasions that
it was my ideas, my program. Yeah, I'm going to. And it's like, wait a second. It's this board that made these recommendations to you. Let's talk about the process, Bruce. You did that with the chief of police. What was the process here?
To be fair, we've had a whole succession of mayors who have the same problem. I mean,
yeah,
Durkin
exactly.
did that. Nichols did that. I mean, how far back do you want to go?
McGinn did that. Yeah, they all do it. It's true.
All right. Anything else on Arrow for the week? All right.
Let's talk a little bit about the city council and what they were up to this week.
Okay.
On Tuesday, at the full city council meeting, the council passed a resolution to put Initiative 135 to create social housing in the city of Seattle on the ballot for February 14th, 2023, for voters to weigh in on. That's Valentine's Day next year. They also voted to approve the appointment of Gino Betts to run the Office of Police Accountability. Betts, if you don't remember, we've talked about him in the past. Betts is coming from the Cook County, Illinois State Attorney's Office, where he's been involved in prosecuting violent crime. He's also served in the Chicago Civilian Office of Police Accountability. Get this, Civilian Office of Police Accountability, something that we should note here in Seattle. From 2017 to 2019, and prior to that, he served in the Cook County Department of Homeland Security in Chicago. Now, when I saw the sort of dog and pony show, the public forum where the candidates for the Office of Police Accountability answered questions that they were fed ahead of time, Gino Betts, I thought, was one of the better candidates. So we will see if he can go into a department like the Office of Police Accountability that's got its own internal issues and problems with folks complaining that they tend to favor police officers over people making complaints, and see if he can make it more responsive to the public. Also this week, I want to talk about a couple of things that happened in two different committees. One is in Dan Strauss's Land Use Committee. I don't talk about that committee very much, but they voted on a bill this week, a very important bill, Council Bill 120394, to change the city's land use requirements to allow more townhouses and row houses and make it easier for developers to build them, easier and less expensive for developers to build them. It passed the committee with Dan Strauss, Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, and Sarah Nelson voting for it, and Alex Peterson voting against it. Peterson had introduced an amendment to try to make the changes a pilot program that the city could study for a couple of years between now and when the next comprehensive plan is finalized in 2024. He used the familiar anti-density argument that developers would be cutting down the city's endangered tree canopy to fit in more townhouses and row houses on each lot, especially in low-density, low-rise neighborhoods. In other words, areas with lots of single-family housing. He also pointed out that townhomes and row houses are not usually considered low-income housing, while multi-story housing is. So essentially, he was making the argument that single-family neighborhoods shouldn't accept more density. That was kind of the what was underlying his argument, and that the city should only allow more density in neighborhoods that are already zoned for taller buildings and have density already. But you know, again, that's gonna shut off more than 70% of the city from accepting more density. But, you know, he could kind of see the writing on the wall and that the other members of the committee were supportive of the bill. So facing the inevitable that he wouldn't be able to stop the bill entirely, he proposed making it a pilot program instead. Dan Strauss argued against that, saying that while townhouses and row houses are not low-income housing, the developers pay money into the city's fund to provide more low-income housing. Strauss also pointed out that the bill would allow developers to build smaller townhouses, making them more affordable. He also, whereas now they have to build them much larger. He also pointed out that he supports Peterson's tree bill that's set to come before the council in December or January, and that they could look at requirements there in terms of replacing trees or in terms of protecting trees on lots that are already there. Now, Nelson pointed out that the bill just makes it less costly for developers to do what they can already do under city law, and it will make townhouses more affordable to build and therefore more affordable to buy. She also talked about how it streamlines the process and gives developers the ability to plan future projects, whereas a pilot program would introduce an element of uncertainty, which is the opposite of what she thinks the city should be doing. And in terms of the way business people think, that is absolutely correct. And she can, I think, be relied on knowing for sure what business owners and developers would be thinking. Now, Peterson emphasized that he just wants data and wants the city to study it, you know, kind of responding to those criticisms. But the committee then voted on the amendment and the other four council members voted it down. So the amendment failed. Then Teresa Mosqueda jumped in and she enthused about how this bill will help create more middle income housing in the city, which is really lacking it. And I think she's right about that. She also pointed out that owning a home in Seattle is so expensive now, with the median price near $1 million. A townhome that costs $600,000 is not low income for sure, but it looks reasonable by comparison. So, for example, if you're making the median income of $110,000, you'd never be able to afford a $1 million home, not even if you have two family members making $110,000 per year. But you could afford a townhouse or a row house on that kind of a salary. Now, the ordinance passed 4-1, and it's going to go to the full council probably the week after next. I didn't see it on the agenda for the full council meeting this coming Tuesday, September 27th. So,
okay.
And then the other committee that I want to talk about is Andrew Lewis's Public Assets and Homelessness Committee passed a resolution number 32067, to support the goals of the Downtown Seattle Association to redesign Third Avenue downtown and make improvements to it. As part of that project, the council would commit to working with Metro, Sound Transit, and the Downtown Seattle Association to study traffic trends, and that includes foot traffic as well as bus travel and automobile travel, and look into ways to make the streetscape more inviting. That might include things like widening the sidewalks, narrowing the street to two or three lanes instead of four, making it a one-way street, opening it up to cars again instead of just buses, or adding a central median where transit riders can board buses instead of having them try to wait in the middle of foot traffic on the sidewalks. Third Avenue has at least a couple of blocks that just aren't fun to walk, and one of them has a building where the landlord has boarded up every single storefront that they own at the street level and has not made any improvements or brought in new tenants. Apparently, the sidewalks are narrower along Third than on other streets, although I have to say, as a person who walks that area regularly, I haven't noticed that. And it's also dominated by massive stores. Some of them are no longer open post-COVID. So it's,
yeah, in fact, between, I think, Pike mm-hmm. and Union, everything is closed.
Everything is closed, yeah.
And one of the problems on Third Avenue, as with some other downtown streets, is that the sidewalks themselves may be wide, but half or more of the sidewalks are given over every couple stores to sidewalks with outdoor seating. Mm-hmm. So that's the city's own problem.
So, yeah, Tammy Morales talked about how there are lots of areas in the city that need streetscape improvements. She represents District 2, which is southeast Seattle, that contains a lot of lower income neighborhoods where the city has, for decades, pretty much ignored providing nice, amenable, nice sort of public amenities to the folks who live there. She was also surprised that the city appears to be working with the Downtown Seattle Association, which represents property owners downtown, but not working with social service providers, transit riders, et cetera. She's interested in what the city can do to make downtown help everyone prosper, not just downtown property owners. And given that Third Avenue is the anchor point for so many bus routes in the city, and routes that take people to outlying areas outside of the city, transportation planning is really key for Third Avenue. That also includes the second tunnel for Sound Transit 3, the light rail line that is going to go from West Seattle through downtown and out to Ballard. Now, Andrew Lewis, to address her questions, Andrew Lewis pointed out that social service providers who run low-income housing along Third Avenue are supportive of the bill. They've had struggles with providing a safe environment for their tenants, and he mentioned Bellwether Housing, which runs several low-income buildings in downtown and Belltown, and Lehigh, who I think runs the Glen Hotel on Third Avenue.
Yes.
Lewis thinks that the city has treated Third as a transit corridor only and hasn't extended the same amenities that it would to a neighborhood thoroughfare. And that has impacted the low-income folks who live along Third, and that the city should start thinking of it not just as a bus corridor, but thinking of Third Avenue as a place where people live, work, shop, and need a welcoming streetscape.
So I'm a little hung up on that because at least the sidewalks on Third Avenue are relatively smooth. You go out to any neighborhood in Seattle and they're all broken up. They haven't been maintained in ages. They've been uprooted by tree routes and thawing.
Where there are sidewalks, there are lots of neighborhoods that don't have them.
I was getting to that, yes. Especially north of 85th and in South Seattle. Those are the two areas with spotty sidewalk coverage.
I think that was Morales's point. Now, Teresa Mosqueda also had some questions, too. She had questions about the cost. She's the chair of the budget committee, so she wanted to know what the cost of all this was going to be. But, of course, the resolution itself didn't contain any cost information. The mayor's budget may have something in it, but, of course, we don't know for sure what's in the mayor's budget yet, though we'll know by next Tuesday. Mosqueda also talked about some of the wording in the proposal that blurs the lines between private space and public space. She's concerned about the potential privatization of public sidewalks so that they can be used for things like street cafes or extensions of storefronts along the street. And she's concerned that this might cause increased police calls regarding trespassing or barring people from what is essentially public space. And she didn't get a good answer about this, other than that SDOT will have control of the public right of way, that it will remain city right of way, and that SDOT will issue permits to private companies for using the sidewalk, but then could also revoke them if necessary. So that's, I think, an open question about all of this, and not really a satisfactory answer. Andrew Lewis also mentioned diversifying storefronts to have other things besides retail downtown that can create a combination of private-public space. So things like art galleries, performance spaces, gyms, food vendors, et cetera, so that you're not just talking about either you go into a department store or you're out on the street. Right, waiting for a bus, that there be some more diversity in terms of what's there. He also made reference to hostel architecture, that arises because the city has failed to plan along Third Avenue, and that people can get into the cynical reactionary attitude because the street is dirty and dangerous. Let's take everything away. Let's put up a bunch of fences. Let's arrest people. Let's sweep the street, et cetera. It's important to not fall into that cycle, and that instead he's hoping that the city will take some time to plan and try to improve the cityscape so that it is more welcoming for people.
I think it should make as many modifications to benefit developers as possible.
Yeah. Now, Lewis was
the same way it has done for the last 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Lewis was persuasive enough that the other committee members voted for it. Now, keep in mind, this resolution is just to support the planning process. It's not to actually put any money to specific changes or to identify specific changes yet. It's just to be supportive of the process of looking at the traffic flow and trying to figure out if there are some improvements that could potentially be made. He was persuasive enough that the other committee members voted for it. Lisa Herbold, Tammy Morales, and Teresa Mosqueda joined Andrew Lewis in passing the resolution. So it's going to go to the full council for approval on the afternoon of Tuesday, September 27th, when the full council will vote on it. And then on the agenda for next week and at the city council, Lisa Herbold's Public Safety and Human Services Committee is going to hear two important presentations. First, the second quarter report from the city attorney's criminal division. That's a requirement that the city council voted into effect after Ann Davison took office, to try to get some understanding from the city attorney's office what they're doing in terms of criminal prosecution, particularly misdemeanors, and whether or not they're fully utilizing the city's diversion programs, as Ann Davison had mentioned during her campaign that she was against diversion programs. So we're going to get that second quarter report from the city attorney's office next week. And then secondly, the long-awaited report from the mayor's office and the Seattle Police Department on their risk-managed demand analysis of 911 calls. This is something the council has been waiting for a long time, and something that the mayor insisted on and that the Seattle Police Department insisted on, that before the city council acted to move any 911 calls to a civilian responders team, that the Seattle Police Department experts in the Seattle Police Department look at and do an analysis of the 911 calls to come up with an analysis of the risk involved in moving certain types of calls. Okay. Because they said that sometimes a call will be classified as lower priority when it first comes into the 911 system, but then it escalates into another higher priority category. And they were concerned that if all low priority calls were moved to civilian responders, that there could be some danger involved there in the types of calls that tend to get escalated. So this risk managed demand analysis is something that the city council has been waiting on so that they can start moving in terms of addressing those lower priority calls that don't get answered by the SPD and moving those to civilian responders. So I think this will also give us a better idea of where the SPD and Mayor Harrell stand in terms of the whole reform process. So that'll be very, very interesting. That committee meeting, the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, will be meeting on Tuesday morning at 9 a.m.
So that'll get everybody a good chunk of reading material after they present that.
Yeah, and I think you can already see the slides for the city attorney's second quarter report on the city council agenda for that committee. You can go in there and look at the slides, although I found that sometimes just looking at the slides doesn't give you quite enough information about them. I usually queue up the video after the meeting and watch the video to see what the city council members are asking and what the presenters answer. Because that can be very informative too, and often they say things that are not on the slides. So,
yeah, or on the summary notes, or half the time they even make the media. So,
yeah, exactly.
We had some census data this week, also.
Oh yeah, local census data.
local yep. census data. And, you know, Maria mentioned earlier, you know, two households making $110,000 each cannot necessarily afford housing. Well, $110,000, specifically $110,800 is now the, new median household income for Seattle. That is to say, half of the people living in Seattle make more than that. Half the people make less. So those of you who don't have six-figure incomes, you are officially poor now in Seattle. Now that compares nationally with $69,700, which is quite a bit lower, obviously. Seattle is, now officially what, 11 divided by 7. It's about 140%, higher in terms of, 160% higher in terms of, household median income and probably also living expenses than the national average. So, you know, anytime you're wondering why the your fixed income, say Social Security, which is done nationally, does not seem to help you make ends meet in Seattle, that's why.
Yeah, and as I was saying earlier, there's the city is starting to build housing for folks who are in the lowest tier of income levels, and there's plenty of housing for people who are above median. But when you get to the middle section there, if you're a couple or you're a person living in rental housing and your income goes up and you think, wow, I'm making pretty good money, you know, I'd like to buy or I'd like to move into a house rather than living in an apartment anymore, then you're kind of out of luck because there's not really much available for folks making a median wage or kind of in the middle area, 80% of median to about 120 to 140% of median. It's really, really difficult to find anything in that.
Yeah.
And so folks are being displaced from the city and they're having to move way out to the suburbs in order to find anything affordable.
I was gonna say, if you don't mind commuting from Moses Lake, you can find something.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you want to live up in Snohomish County or you want to live down in Pierce County, you can find something. But that's a long, long drive.
Yep.
Yes, and not particularly good for the environment, which
no.
continues to fry.
No.
All right.
Well, Mayor Harrell will do something about that.
I'm looking forward to the brochure on that. Trump crime family updates.
Oh, there were lots this week. New York State Attorney General Letitia James dropped a blockbuster lawsuit on Donald Trump, the Trump Organization, his three kids who were involved in running the Trump Organization. It's a 220-page, highly detailed lawsuit, which basically traces through all the different ways that Donald Trump personally, his kids personally, and the Trump Organization overvalued assets and then undervalued them for tax returns. In other words, they were lying one way or the other, and not just by, you know, $20,000 here or $100,000 there. We're talking often by a factor of, you know, multiples of 10. It was really staggeringly ballsy, shall we say. And, you know, a lot of people have said, well, this is just a civil lawsuit. It doesn't mean that much. You'll settle out of court. Well, you know, James is asking for Trump and his three kids to be unable to run any organization, any corporate organization inside the state of New York. It's basically a corporate death sentence. That, and there were two criminal referrals on this. There was a criminal referral to the Department of Justice for the defrauding of various banks and lenders. And there was also a criminal referral to the IRS. And the IRS one, I think, is going to be particularly lethal because if there's anything that the IRS does not like, it is somebody who has defrauded the government of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And James has the receipts right down to the conversations in which Trump himself is ordering this kind of stuff. Now, Trump somewhat predictably railed against the lawsuit and railed against James as being a political witch-hunt. But as with the seizure of secret documents at Mar-a-Lago, he did not address the substance of the charges at all because he can't. She's got him dead to rights on the judging by appearances of it. That was not the only thing that happened to Trump on Wednesday. It was a very bad day for him because an appeals panel in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals based in Atlanta overturned Judge Cannon's somewhat inexplicable ruling a couple weeks ago that the Department of Justice not be able to use the classified documents that it seized in Mar-a-Lago in its criminal investigation of Donald Trump, and that intelligence agencies could not use the documents in their assessment of potential damage that keeping top secret documents in plain public access for a year and a half, what that might have caused. So they overturned that. It was three judges ruling unanimously. Two of those judges were Trump appointees, and the Trump lawyers will almost certainly appeal it to the full circuit and then to the Supreme Court, but I don't expect that they'll have much better luck there. So it was not a good week for him. And there were a bunch of other lesser things too. I mean, there's an enormous amount of Trump-related news going around right now, but those were the two major ones. I would mention also that Trump, in his speeches, is now openly embracing QAnon, which he's not done before, and that should that's a somewhat worrisome prospect for the person who is still the odds-on favorite to be the Republican presidential nominee in 2024, if he's not in prison.
Also this week, a jury in a federal court case Thursday found that Project Veritas.
Yeah, that's the James O'Keefe project that literally for at least the last 15 years since it used a misleading video to get to basically destroy the nonprofit Acorn, has been using misleadingly edited videos to try and frame different Democrats. Well, one of the targets of those that video, a Democratic political consultant, sued the Project Veritas, claiming that it had used deceptive tactics, it violated wiretapping laws, and fraudulently misrepresented itself as part of a lengthy sting operation. Jury in that federal civil case on Thursday found that Project Veritas had in fact done all those things. There's a separate part of the process that will determine the award, but it could cripple Project Veritas, and I gotta say it's long overdue, because it's been one of the more unprincipled media actors in the American political landscape over the last 15 years.
That's a fairly high bar to have to jump.
I'm aware that it is, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on. Judge yesterday in Arizona, ruled that Arizona can enforce a near total ban on abortions?
Yes. That had been blocked for nearly 50 years, but a judge ruled Friday that clinics across that state will have to stop providing the procedures to avoid the filing of criminal charges against both doctors and other medical workers. An injunction had blocked an enforcement of the law, which had been on the books since before Arizona became a state in 1912. That law bans nearly all abortions. The only exception is if a woman's life is in jeopardy. So if you've been raped or if you were a victim of incest, tough.
You know? Or if you're 9 years old.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're seeing this in Republican-run states across the country. The cruelty is the point. This has been the point of Republican politics for the last several years since the ascension of Donald Trump. And it continues to infect the party, and it's a sad day for people living in those states.
All right. Moving on, Elijah McClain.
Yes.
Back into the news.
Yes, there were a couple of police accountability stories this week nationally. One, Elijah McClain, who was a 25-year-old, I believe, man in no 23-year-old man in suburban Denver, who was killed by Aurora, Colorado police in 2019. The medical examiner amended the autopsy report for McClain to say that he died because he was injected with a powerful sedative after being forcibly restrained. That means he was killed, right? Well, no, his autopsy still lists the cause of death is undetermined, not as a homicide, the report shows. McClain was put in a neck hold and injected with ketamine after being stopped by police in Aurora for, quote-unquote, being suspicious. He was unarmed, of course. This is a black man who was killed by white police officers, and it resulted in several years' worth of protests in the Denver area before the charges were finally brought. Very sad story. And watch for this one. Also in Colorado, in Platteville, which is a rural area north of Denver, a police officer has been suspended with pay after last Saturday parking his vehicle on railroad tracks with a handcuffed suspect in the back seat, and then getting out and telling the suspect to wait for a train. That's kind of psychotic. Apparently he is getting a paid vacation now for that stunt. Welcome to police accountability, still in 2022.
Okay. All right. Well, normally we do a pandemic update in between local and national, but apparently they're turning off the whole thing at the national level.
Well, according to Joe Biden, the pandemic is over. However, we are going into the season when it gets cooler and people move indoors to areas where the air doesn't circulate as cleanly, and therefore an airborne virus like SARS-CoV-2 is more likely to spread. And we have a couple new subvariants to talk about. BA2.75.2, and yes, I know that rolls right off the tongue, and BQ.1.1. The BQ1.1 is particularly worrisome because it evades the new virus, new vaccine rather, as well as the previous vaccines quite effectively, apparently. And this is not a surprise. Experts have been warning for a long time that as the weather cools and we're going to see more subvariants, the virus is going to spread again. The numbers, both locally and nationally, have been slowly declining over the past couple of months, but watch for them to tick up in the next few weeks. I think that's almost inevitable. So don't stop wearing your mask in public places, especially indoors. You know. I know people are tired of the pandemic, but it is not time just yet to relax your guard.
Moving on then to international and developments this week in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, and in Russia, Vladimir Putin, after delaying it for 24 hours, had an address in which he ordered a new draft for a new call-up for conscription for the Russian army. That is not likely on the battlefield to be very beneficial, at least not in the short run, because it takes time to train and arm those conscripts. And, you know, given that the anecdotal reports from the battlefield over the last 6 months have been that the Russian conscripts who are already fighting are very poorly trained and had no idea why they were there in the first place, it may well be that Putin just sticks them onto the battlefield as cannon fodder. with no expectation that they'll be an effective fighting force. So it's not likely to help stem the counteroffensive that Ukraine has been very successfully waging for the last several weeks. The other aspect of that is that there is already reports in Western media of widespread resistance to that draft call-up. I can say personally from my trip to the then Soviet Union in the late 80s that I met with people who were involved in a very widespread underground resistance network to the conscription laws of that time. And if that network has survived in any form at all, you can expect to see widespread resistance again. We're seeing reports in the New York Times and the British media of, you know, Russian men suddenly going, suddenly disappearing, quote unquote. They may be trying to leave the country, or they may just be living underground with sympathetic people. So that's not likely to be very effective. Meanwhile, the fake referenda that are being held in four Russian-controlled provinces in eastern Ukraine, southeastern Ukraine, are underway. We're already seeing reports that people are being forced to vote a certain way in that referendum. So, you know, probably next week Russia will trumpet and say, see, these people want to become part of Russia. Let's call them part of Russia. And then claim that Ukraine is invading Russia. That will be the propaganda route that that takes. I don't think anybody outside Russia is going to take that seriously. But Putin's more worried about the domestic audience right now, because his grip in power, as it becomes clear that the war, the invasion of Ukraine has been a disaster for Russia. You know, his grip on power and his aura of invincibility is slipping. And so he's much more worried about the domestic audience at this point and trying to maintain that illusion of invincibility.
He did weave using nuclear weapons into one of his speeches this last week.
Yeah, that was the same speech in which he announced the call-up. I actually was listening to it live when he started launching into the "Don't forget, we've got nuclear weapons and we're not afraid to use them" routine. You know, he's right. They do have nuclear weapons, and he would probably rather use them than give up his grip on power. That should be very concerning for the rest of the world.
Iran.
Yeah, widespread protests in Iran this week after a 22-year-old woman in Tehran, was killed after Iran's notorious morality police arrested her because they thought she was not dressed conservatively enough. She was killed in custody. The details of that have not been released, but the protests over her death have been enormous. Certainly the largest protests that have been seen in major Iranian cities for at least the last decade. So keep an eye on that.
There were some concerns there too, because she was a member of the Kurdish minority.
Yes.
In Iran, and they have suffered some repression from the central government in Tehran.
As with every country in which the Kurds are present, Syria, mm-hmm. Turkey, Iraq, Iran.
But I think it really points to wider dissatisfaction with the morality police in Tehran, that someone can be detained and abused or denied the ability to address what is an impending health crisis. The government said that she had a heart condition and suffered a heart attack, although there are questions about whether she was also abused by the morality police. And that is just outright repression. And there have been a lot of protests in Iran about the existence of the morality police. While the culture is shifting to a more liberal culture, the government is not. So
yeah, And Iran culturally has always been somewhat pro-Western, and that's what the revolution over the last 40 years has been trying to undo. But it's always been sympathetic to Western dress and Western culture. So, you know, going back to the days of the Shah. So that continues to be an issue. And the morality police are notorious for physically abusing their arrestees. That's another subtext to this. So nobody really quite believes that the heart condition is what killed her.
Yeah, she was 29 years old, so.
No, she's 22.
Or 22. I thought 29. Still, when you're in your 20s, it's extremely rare for someone to just have a spontaneous heart attack.
Yeah, especially women.
And Haiti.
Yeah, Haiti has also been having widespread protests, in some degree devolving into riots. That has been over a sudden spike in fuel prices and similarly food prices. Haiti is the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere, a relic of its old colonial days and the punishment by the United States and other countries that it was the first country in the Western Hemisphere to free its slaves. Literally, it was a slave rebellion that founded Haiti. And particularly wealthy landowners in the South wanted to punish Haiti because it wasn't, it was a bad example, basically. So, dating to those colonial days, Haiti has always been impoverished, has always been a plaything for Western colonialists. And a local repressive local establishment going back to the dictatorship of the Duvaliers, supported by the United States, of course. And it's been very unstable ever since and has had a lot of different factions, some of them armed and vicious, ever since. And so when you have widespread protests like that, some of the news accounts say it's devolving into anarchy. Well, yes, in that crimes are committed under the cover of those protests that simply are not prosecuted and are not investigated. So hopefully Haiti will become stable again soon, but right now it's a mess again.
All right, and finally, Hurricane Fiona.
Yes, welcome to climate change, this week's edition. Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico early in the week, and power is still out on much of that island. Of course, that island is still recovering from Maria 4 years ago, the hurricane, not the person. And
not me.
So, yeah, so this morning it hit the Maritime Provinces of Canada. No longer considered a hurricane. It's post-tropical because it's so far north, but it still hit Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island with 100-mile-an-hour winds, which is a record for Canada. Canada has never been hit with a cyclonic storm, whatever you call it, with that ferocity of winds. Fortunately, there's not a lot of rain. It was a fast-moving storm at that point. But power is out in most of those two provinces.
So that's literally hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, 70% of Nova Scotia and 85% of PEI. PEI is about 150,000 people. Nova Scotia has about 1 million. So, yeah, that's a lot of people. It includes the city of Halifax in Nova Scotia.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time for this week, but
we'll have a budget to talk about next week. That'll be
yes, we will.